Good afternoon, Shabbat Shalom. Greetings from Osceola County in Central Florida, Kissimmee. Near the happiest place on earth. We hope that you're happy wherever you are. And we hope you'll be happy with what we're going to be covering today. We still appreciate your prayers for this area in terms of the dry lack of rain here. I mean, it's a wet area in general. I mean, it's a kind of a lot of ponds, a lot of moisture, but we need more rain in this area, so we'd appreciate your prayers for us in that regard. And I hope that you're staying well. It seems like things may be settling down. We went through this in the 70s, a lot of us remember something similar. There was a far more panic at that time over it than seems to be the case now. So let's hope that things will settle out and there won't be some major health issue here or anywhere else for that matter. You know, I wanted to have a clever title for what I was going to cover. I wanted to use alliteration, you know, like something that has to do with Davidic. I mean, you've all heard of Davidic dancing. Davidic dancing is what we might call folk dancing, but calling it Davidic dancing gives it a certain, you know, what's the word, biblical veneer or something, patina, whatever the word is of it, justification, kashrut, heksher, imprimatur. But anyway, I thought I'd call it Davidic doctrine, Davidic discussion. But, you know, I've used those terms in the past. I probably, those, if you looked on my list of available lessons from the past, I've already used those terms. So I'm stuck with learning from David. That's what we're going to get today. Very prosaic title, Learning from David. You know, I thought about the Bible, which, you know, obviously a person ought to do. And I was thinking that a tremendous amount of the Bible has to do with Paul. Well, actually, I'll start with John. There are five books that are connected to John. You have John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and Revelation. Then you have, and even the scholars who argue over which John wrote which book, put them in the same body of material. They call it the Johannine writings. Then you have, of course, Paul. And a huge chunk of the New Testament has to do with Paul, either directly or indirectly. More of the New Testament is related to Paul than any other person in that sense. I mean, obviously it's all about Jesus Christ, but as far as authorship and what person is talked about, Paul is the most in terms of the contribution of material. Then you go to the Old Testament, and of course Moses stands out. The five books of Moses, and so much is attributed to Moses. But then another major name in the Bible, is David. A tremendous amount of the Bible is either talking about David or composed by David, David, in effect, was the composer of the hymnal of the church, if you want to look at it that way. Who was the composer of our hymnal? David. But there's so much about David in the Bible, in the Old Testament. And there's a good reason for that, of course, because David is the ancestor of Jesus Christ. I was originally going to go into some genealogy and talk about that, but I might do that at another time. You all know, though, the background. God works with families, and he worked with a particular family in terms of making his plan of salvation. He chose Abraham, and then he chose Judah. From Judah, he chose David, and then he made a commitment to David. He said, you're going to be the ancestor of the King of Kings. So when God chose to become human, he chose to become a human who was a descendant of David. So therefore our Savior is Davidic and divine. Jesus Christ, the Messiah, Mashiach, Christos in the Greek, the Anointed One, is Davidic and also divine. I'd like to go to Acts 13. And in verse 22, I'm starting here. This is a very basic starting point. It summarizes Old Testament teaching and helps us to get a perspective, and also New Testament teaching for that matter. Acts 13 and verse 22. Now God gave them ancient Israel judges, and then they wanted a king. He gave them a king. That king didn't do so well in the long run. Had his problems. So he was replaced. Acts 13:21. Acts 13:21. And afterwards they asked for a king. So God gave them Saul, the son of Kish, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, for 40 years. This is verse 22 now. And when he had removed him, he raised up for him David, meaning beloved. He raised up for them David as king, to whom also he gave testimony and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, who will do all my will. Verse 23, from this man's seed, according to the promise, God raised up for Israel a Savior, Jesus. So here we are, you know, that's a very basic truth that we understand, that we need to be aware of. Now, what was so special about David? One thing that was special about David is that he was willing to go above and beyond. You know, it's okay if you're asked to do a job and you do exactly what you have to do. That's fine. I hire you to do the job. You do the job. You get your salary. You go home. But what happens when you go above and beyond? What we call in the military, what they call in the military, above and beyond the call of duty. Well, then you're heroic. Then you're somebody special. And yet, such people are needed, really. If the world is going to function, we have to have people who don't just put in their time 8 to 5 and go home, and that's fine, but they're willing to go above and beyond, maybe think about their job when they're not on the job, how can I do a better job when I'm there, that sort of thing, to go above and beyond. And it's interesting, in Luke 17, it is going above and beyond that builds our faith. Faith is a very delicate matter and a very important matter, and faith is an issue that comes up, and the way of one's faith is increased is when one goes above and beyond. Now, that doesn't mean fanaticism, because the Bible warns about that. There's a lot, particularly in the New Testament. Christ was dealing with the Pharisees who had gone to extremes, not more than above and beyond, they'd gone to extremes. And extremes can be self-defeating. Extremes can take the basic core and actually mangle it. You know, for example, when you get so fanatical about the Sabbath, you can actually hurt the Sabbath rather than help it. You can make the Sabbath a burden rather than a delight as it's intended. Sabbath is intended to be a delight, with in Hebrew an oneg. And in fact, the Jews have these parties on Shabbat. They call it oneg Shabbat, you know, and it's supposed to be a delight. But the Pharisees' complex Sabbath rules had made it into a burden. So there's fanaticism, and that's wrong. But zeal is right. Zeal is good. Going above and beyond is ideal. And that's what David did. He went above and beyond, as we will see. And in Luke 17, verse 5, and the apostle said to the Lord, increase our faith. So the Lord said, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you can say to this mulberry tree, be pulled up by the roots and be planted in the sea, and it would obey you. It's interesting, you know, I noticed that he mentions a mulberry tree. Mulberry trees will come up in just a moment regarding David. So there's probably some symbolism in that kind of tree, although, frankly, I'm not sure that we really know what kind of tree is being discussed here. But the translation here says mulberry. I'm not sure what other... there may be other translations of that. But there's a symbolism that ties back into David's life, as we'll see. And which of you, having a servant plowing or tending sheep, will say to him when he has come in from the field, come at once and sit down to eat? You know, when you have a servant, he's not finished until he does what he has to do. Then he can go home and do what he, you know, or he can sit and stop or whatever. But first he has to finish his job. Verse 8, but will he not rather say to him, prepare something for my supper and gird yourself and serve me till I have eaten and drunk, and afterward you will eat and drink. Do your job and then you can relax. Does he thank that servant because he did the things that were commanded him? I think not. So likewise you, this is Luke 17:10. So likewise you, when you have done all those things which you are commanded, say, we are unprofitable servants. We have done what was our duty to do. An unprofitable servant is one who just does what's expected. That's okay, but he's unprofitable because we should be willing to go above and beyond what we're asked to do. And if we do that, our faith will increase. And this is this is what David's attitude was. He had such a reverence for God, such a love and such a gratitude that he wanted to go above and beyond. And so God was certainly impressed with that. If you look at it humanly, speaking anthropomorphically, God was impressed with that. And so God blessed David, and God chose David to be the ancestor of the Messiah. And David himself will be given a great reward, although he obviously is not the Messiah. He's the ancestor of the Messiah, because God himself is the Messiah. You know, and so, but David, under Christ, will be king over all of Israel in the millennium. When Israel is restored, when Christ returns, his ancestor, David, will, of course, also be serving under him, and David will be king over all the tribes of Israel. And, of course, the apostles will be ruling over the 12 tribes, the 12 apostles, as we know from the Scripture. I'd like to go now there and talk a little bit about the career of David. And, of course, there's so much in the Bible, as I said, about David. So from time to time, we do need to go back and get the data in mind and cover this material about David. I'd like to go to 1 Chronicles to begin. 1 Chronicles 11. Now, David, at first, ruled in the south of the land of Israel, the area of the tribe of Judah. And the major city there was Hebron. Today it's located in the so-called West Bank. But Hebron was a city that Caleb was given, but also it became a priestly city. So Caleb had the area around the city, and the actual, I think, core of the city was given, I believe, to the priests, to the ancestors of Aaron. I'm sorry, the descendants of Aaron. So it was a priestly city, but also it was a city of Judah. David was ruling from that city in the south. But then the other tribes came to him, and they wanted to all unify under David, the whole nation being ruled by David. So he ruled over the south for 7.5 years, and then 33 years over the United Kingdom, so total of 40 years that he reigned, as we see in 1 Samuel. In 1 Chronicles 11 and beginning of that chapter, then all Israel came together to David at Hebron, saying, "Indeed, we are your bone and your flesh. Also, in time past, even when Saul was king, you were the one who led Israel out and brought them in." You know, David was doing all kinds of wonderful things, even when he was a fugitive. And he was respected and loved. You know, it was kind of like a Robin Hood situation where he was an outlaw and yet not really, you know, that sort of thing. And David was very respected, and people knew that Samuel had anointed him king. Samuel was, of course, very respected. Excuse me. "Also, in time past, even when Saul was king, you were the one who led Israel out and brought them in. And the Eternal your God said to you, 'You shall shepherd my people Israel and be ruler over my people Israel.'" And, of course, he's playing on the fact that David, as a career, was a shepherd initially. But now he's going to be a shepherd over people. Just as God said to the, as Christ said to the apostles, they were fishermen. He said, "I'm going to make you fishers of men," you know. So David was a shepherd who became shepherd over God's people. As Moses in the past had the same kind of background. He was a general over the army. Then he was a shepherd over flocks. And then he became the leader of the people of Israel. Anyway, in 1 Chronicles 11:3, "Therefore all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Eternal. And they anointed David king over Israel according to the word of the Eternal by Samuel." So now things were the way they should have been. He was now ruling over Israel as God had intended, as Samuel had anointed him to do. "And David and all Israel went to Jerusalem, which is Jebus, where the Jebusites were, the inhabitants of the land." Now the Jebusites were a Canaanite people. The Canaanites were unfortunately a people who were depraved, you know, a people very sad. Their culture had degenerated into a very self-destructive culture. Some of their practices are talked about in Leviticus 18 and elsewhere. Very vile practices. So they had really come to the point where God had did not want them to be in that land, and that land, in effect, he had reserved ultimately to give to his people. But the Israelites were not quite as zealous as they should have been and as close to God as they should have been. So they had to share the land with the Canaanites for a period of time. And in the city of Jebus, for example, when all was said and done, they were not able to hold it and maintain it. So they shared it for a time with the Jebusites. And I suspect that by the time that I'm reading about here, the Jebusites had pretty much come to dominate and the Israelites were not there anymore. It had become once again a Jebusite city. So the Israelites had actually probably at this point been driven out of that area of the city of Jebus. But the city of Jebus actually was Salem in biblical time, in earlier times. Melchizedek had ruled there, the righteous king and, you know, the priest. Melchizedek had been there. And Abraham, as you know, had dealings with Melchizedek. And now this city is called Jerusalem, but at that time it was Jebus. The Jebusites were there. Now, Jerusalem was a very good place to be capital of the nation because it was in the center of Israel, and it was up from the area around it, and it had a water supply, so it could be defended and was militarily, geopolitically in a good position. And as I said, from a geographical point of view, was in a good position to be at the center of the nation. So it was chosen to be the capital of the nation. And of course, that was prophesied way back in the book of Moses that the temple ultimately would be in that area. Most of that area was within the territory of Judah. A little piece of Jerusalem was in the territory of Benjamin, and that little piece was Mount Moriah, where the temple was eventually built. If you don't mind, I hadn't planned to do this, but I'll go back to a prophecy about that. Jerusalem was in Judah's territory, as I've said, but a little bit of it was in Benjamin's territory. Benjamin's territory extended out just a bit, projected out into the area of Mount Moriah. So I want to go to Genesis 49. I'm sorry, Deuteronomy 33. I apologize. Deuteronomy 33. I remember in my summers in Israel going to an area where there was a sign, this is the border between Benjamin and Judah in biblical times. You know, it's interesting. I think they probably have all of the various borders marked in Israel of the 12 tribes. And I remember going to a place called Abu Ghosh, which is the biblical Kiryat Yearim, where the Ark of the Covenant rested for many years. I remember being there. And I'll have more to say about that in a little while. But anyway, if you go to Deuteronomy 33, there's a prophecy here about Benjamin. I'm going to verse 12 of Deuteronomy 33. Of Benjamin he said, the beloved of the Eternal shall dwell in safety by him, who shelters him all the day long, and he shall dwell between his shoulders. So this is talking about the fact that the temple was going to rest, you know, in the area, in the territory of Benjamin. And it would be in a secure spot, and it would be in the territory of Benjamin. Ultimately, God's presence would be there, Mount Moriah. So anyway, we'll go back now to 1 Chronicles 11. So here David wants to conquer this city, which should have been an Israelite city, but the Jebusites were there. And they needed to be driven out, and he was intending to make that city his capital. As sometimes people say, Jerusalem, D.C. Jerusalem, David's capital. So in 1 Chronicles 11, let's go to verse 4. 1 Chronicles 11:4. And David and all Israel went to Jerusalem, which is Jebus, where the Jebusites were, the inhabitants of the land. But the inhabitants of Jebus said to David, you shall not come in here. In other words, they were very arrogant about it. They thought they could defeat him, but it didn't work out that way. Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. So that there's an area there which is called Mount Zion, Har Zion, and that is also there, and that's where David built his palace, and the temple was on Mount Moriah. Now David said, whoever attacks the Jebusites first shall be chief and captain. So he was looking for somebody who to have the initiative to lead the assault, and he was going to reward him with leadership of the military, and that was Joab, who for a time, you know, commanded David's army. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, went up first and became chief. Then David dwelt in the stronghold, therefore they called it the city of David. I was involved in excavations in that area as a young man in 1969 and 1970. verse 8, and he built the city around it from the Milo. This means a landfill. Evidently, there was an area that was somewhat depressed, and they filled it up and then built on it. And he built the city around it from the Milo to the surrounding area. Joab repaired the rest of the city, or revived the rest of the city. So it, after the Jebusites were driven out, it was repopulated and rebuilt with Israelites, became David's capital. And David ruled from 1008 B.C. to 968 B.C., 40 years, and the last 33 from Jerusalem. So David went on and became great, and the Eternal of Hosts was with him. Let's go back now to 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel, the 6th chapter, I believe, is what I want. I want to talk a little bit more about David's career. As I said, he was one who was very zealous for God, very respectful, very reverential, and he went above and beyond in his relationship with God. I want to go to 1 Samuel... I'm sorry, did I say 1 Samuel? 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel. I want 2 Samuel, the 6th chapter. If you don't mind, I'm going to go back to the 5th chapter of 2 Samuel, and I want to go to verse 17. Here you see that God gave David certain victories. David did participate in warfare. He did have to go through those experiences as a secular ruler, but at the same time he had divine help, and he was interacting with God at the time, and God was guiding him in a supernatural way and had a relationship with him which was quite special. Even though David did have to involve himself in military activity, you know, God was directing it. In 2 Samuel 5:17, now when the Philistines heard that they had anointed David king over Israel, all the Philistines went up to search for David, and David heard of it and went down to the stronghold. So now David is having to face quite a test. Philistines are southwest of where he is, in the area of Gaza today. So you see that the history of that area doesn't seem to change much. There were problems today with Gaza. There were problems then with Gaza. Except in those days they didn't have rockets to fire. In verse 18, the Philistines also went and deployed themselves in the valley of Rephaim. So David inquired of the Eternal, saying, "Shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you deliver them into my hand?" And the Eternal said to David, "Go up, for I will doubtless deliver the Philistines into your hand." So there are very few military commanders in history who could have had that kind of experience, you know, praying and getting a direct answer like that. Go ahead, do it, you will win. Tremendous. So David went to Baal Perazim, in other words, the master of breakouts, because he gave it that name because of what happened. And David defeated them there and said, "The Eternal has broken through my enemies before me like a breakthrough of water." Therefore, he called the name of the place Baal Perazim, right? You know, master of breakthroughs, because of the triumph that he had there. And they left their images there, and David and his men carried them away. So they had these idols, they took the idols away. Then the Philistines went up once again and deployed themselves in the valley of Rephaim. This area evidently had been occupied in earlier years by giants, but in this case the Philistines were assembling there. It's an area near Bethlehem today, what we call Bethlehem today. Therefore David inquired of the Eternal, and he said, "You shall not go up." So God even directed what strategy for him to use, evidently testing him to see if he would do it the way he was told, which he did. "You shall not go up. Circle around behind them and come upon them in front of the mulberry trees." It's interesting. Once again, we have mulberry trees here. And these seem to be symbolic in a certain way. And this, of course, required faith. Do it God's way, not your own way. "And it shall be when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the mulberry trees, then you shall advance quickly." So evidently the trees would sway a bit as the army would march. It perhaps caused a bit of shaking of the earth or maybe a stirring of the wind. And the mulberry trees would stir a bit and you'd hear a little bit of noise from the leaves. Then you'd know it's time to strike. And it kind of reminds me in the Battle of Bunker Hill, which was really fought on Breed's Hill in Boston. Supposedly the commander said, "Don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes." That was a famous line. And so in this case, God is telling him, don't attack until you hear the rustling of the trees. I happened to be driving down the road recently, and there was a preacher on the radio, and he what he said might have some, you know, could very well be true. In his mind, the rustling of the wind in the mulberry trees was symbolic of God's Spirit acting. And I think he's correct that, you know, based upon, you know, when you read the Bible, that the rustling of the wind is symbolic of God's Spirit. This was divine intervention to give David an amazing victory, because God is establishing him now as a feared power in the region. He became the major power in that region, to where David dominated the area from the Nile to the Euphrates, from the, at least the river of Egypt, you know, the what they call the Wadi El Arish, all the way till the Euphrates, became Davidic realm. You know, Israel's power was great in that region. They weren't so much a world power from the point of view of nowadays, but they were certainly what we would call a regional power. So anyway, in verse 24, "And it shall be when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the mulberry trees, then you shall advance quickly, for then the Eternal will go out before you to strike the camp of the Philistines. And David did so as the Eternal commanded him, and he drove back the Philistines from Geba as far as Gezer." So he drove them, you know, further south, further west, away from the heartland of his country. Now David turned to spiritual matters. He had consolidated his control, and now he turned to spiritual matters. And the ark was in a place which, as I said before, we call it Abu Ghosh today. See, now I'm beginning to preach in such a way that I'm beginning to stir. The young prince is stirring there. But nevertheless, he cannot interrupt my sermon. He'll just have to learn. We'll just have to learn to coexist, the young prince and I. All right, he's preparing for when he begins to pastor this congregation, you know, when he gives the talks. But anyway, it was in an area we call Abu Ghosh today, which was a Christian Arab town in modern times, and in biblical times it was called the City of the Forests, Kiryat Yarim. But the Ark of the Covenant rested there for a time, and today the Catholics have built a monastery there, a church there, which is in honor of Mary. Because in their, which is not, you know, it's an interesting analogy. Mary had God in her, just as the Ark of the Covenant had God's presence within it. Mary had the God in her womb, and so as a symbol of the Ark of the Covenant being in Abu Ghosh, the Catholics built a monastery in honor of Mary. And I remember touring it as a young man with a friend of mine from UCLA, and there was a nun, that very sweet lady, that toured us around. And she sang to us, you know, Do Re Mi. No, I'm kidding. But she was a very sweet lady, and she spoke French, Arabic, and Hebrew. She didn't speak any English, but she spoke French, Arabic, and Hebrew. Anyway, that area in the Bible is Kiryat Yarim, and the Ark was there. But he wanted it to come to Jerusalem, his capital, and eventually he would build a temple around it. He as you'll see, or he thought to. His son Solomon finally did that. But he had thought, but at least he wanted the tabernacle to be there at his capital. And remember, Mount Moriah is where Abraham sacrificed Isaac, or nearly did. So it's a very special spot. Anyway, in 2 Samuel 6, verse 10, well, let's go to verse 11. The Ark of the Eternal, of course, this is before the days of Indiana Jones or any of that. This is when the Ark of the Covenant was back there in Abu Ghosh. The Ark of the Eternal remained in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, 3 months, and the Eternal blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. So the Ark had been put there. I don't want to get into all the complications of how it wound up in that home, but it was in that home for 3 months, and God blessed the people in that home. But now it was time to further move it to where it needed to be. Verse 12, "Now it was told King David, saying, The Eternal has blessed the house of Obed-Edom, and all that belongs to him because of the Ark of God." So now David felt, okay, there had been some trouble, but now David felt the time has come to continue moving the Ark. It looks as though now we're in a positive climate. Let's pursue this matter. And as I said, David wanted to do the right thing spiritually. It wasn't just setting himself up geopolitically. He wanted also to have a theocratic nation. He wanted a nation that would be God's nation. So David went and brought up the Ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with gladness. Now this was a very special occasion for David, and he was so joyful and so enthusiastic. And it's interesting, we can get enthusiastic nowadays about all kinds of things, and we don't seem to often get enthusiastic enough about really important things. again, it doesn't mean that you need to be hysterical in a wrong way, you know, and kind of put on the, you know, what's the right word? Put on the enthusiasm in an artificial way, a syrupy, gooey, melodramatic way. You know, that really is not what you need to do. You either feel it or you don't. And but if you do feel it, then that's great. And so it was when those bearing the ark of the Eternal had gone six paces that he sacrificed oxen and fatted sheep. So once the project was underway, he'd sacrificed to God. He was excited about this. This was a very holy act. He was now setting up a permanent place for that Ark of the Covenant, which had been in various locations over the centuries. Now it was going to be permanently in the capital of the nation. Then David danced before the Eternal. The margin says, whirled about. So it wasn't quite the minuet, you know, it was quite an enthusiastic dance. Then David danced before the Eternal with all his might, and David was wearing a linen ephod. He evidently had a covering, a cloak kind of covering, like kind of like a tunic. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the Ark of the Eternal with shouting and with the sound of the trumpet. Now, if you wear that kind of an outfit, like kind of like a kilt, perhaps, you know, when you do this dancing, occasionally I suppose the kilt might be lifted and all, and you know, it's perhaps a little on the wild side. But David was really enthusiastic, and he was dancing, and he didn't think of it as necessarily a bad thing. Now, as the Ark of the Eternal came into the city of David, Michal, Saul's daughter, looked through a window. And, of course, this was one of David's wives. And this was the wife that he had acquired from Saul. I think it was his first wife, and he had regained her. You know, Saul had given her to somebody else, and then he wanted her back, and he regained her. Now, as the Ark of the Eternal came into the city of David, Michal, Saul's daughter, looked through a window and saw David leaping and whirling before the Eternal, and she despised him in her heart. Now, she evidently felt like, well, he's the king, and he needs to be dignified, and he shouldn't be out there celebrating in that way. And it's a wrong attitude. There's a time to you know, let your hair down and celebrate. And, you know, she evidently had a kind of an incorrect idea of how a ruler should behave. And what your attitude should be about godly things. So they brought the ark. But anyway, she really, really angry. She really was angry with David for that. So they brought the Ark of the Eternal and set it in its kind of, you know, it kind of reminds me of. I'm not sure if we have the same issue now, but I think we will always have that issue. No matter how much feminism becomes the norm, no matter how much we have equality between, you know, men and women, there still are people that are going to be status conscious. And in the past, many times a man who had a title was a fairly humble man, but his wife would insist that every honor be paid to this title. I remember one of my great instructors in my life was a man named Koch, you know, who was my German instructor in Brooklyn College, and he was from Germany, and he really represented, in my opinion, the best of German culture. Germany at its best. And he talked about how in Germany many people would get very highly educated, so they would not only have one doctorate but two doctorates or even three, and you were supposed to call them doctor, doctor, or doctor, doctor, doctor. In America, I think if you just get more and more education, they don't do that. Even if you have a second PhD, they don't call you doctor, doctor. But in Germany, they would call you doctor, doctor, or doctor, doctor, doctor. And the comment that he made was interesting. He said sometimes the men didn't really care if you forgot to say doctor, doctor, but the wife, she insisted, he's doctor, doctor, you know. And that's sometimes the way it is. And so maybe her attitude was, well, he's the king. And because she was maybe first lady in her mind, you know, she felt like, well, somehow he was taken away from her by being so undignified as to dance around in this wild way. But he was doing it, you know, because of his love for God and for this situation here. But I guess in her mind, he was taken away from their status, maybe their dignity in front of everybody, you know. Anyway, so they brought the Ark of the Eternal and set it in its place in the midst of the tabernacle that David had erected for it. Then David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Eternal. And when David had finished offering burnt offerings and peace offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Eternal of hosts. But he did more than that. He actually distributed goods among them. He shared. He was the king. He was probably, as king, very wealthy. And he had resources. So he gave sacrifices to God, yes, but he also gave goodies, you might say, to those who participated. He was very generous. Then he distributed among all the people, among the whole multitude of Israel, both the women and the men, to everyone a loaf of bread, a piece of meat, and a cake of raisins. So all the people departed, everyone to his house. So everybody, you know, had food. It was just a great time for everybody. Then David returned to bless his household. And Michal, the daughter of Solomon, came out to meet David and said, and she insulted him. I mean, what a time to insult your husband. He has just had this wonderful day. You know, what do you, at a time like that, you know, you're on cloud nine, and you come home, and what do you get? You know, this battle axe at the door, you know. How glorious was the king of Israel today, uncovering himself today in the eyes of the maids of his servants, as one of the base fellows shamelessly uncovers himself. Well, that's not what he was doing. He probably jumped around, and so the kilt, you know, blew up in the air a few times, and, you know, maybe you could see his thighs or whatever. That wasn't what he was doing, but that's the way she interpreted it there. So David said to Michal, "It was before the Eternal who chose me instead of your father and all his house to appoint me ruler." You know, he chose me rather than Saul and rather than that family, rather than that tribe, who chose me instead of your father and all his house to appoint me ruler over the people of the Eternal, over Israel. Therefore I will play music before the Eternal. And I will be even more undignified than this. You know, if I feel like it, I'll even go beyond what I did today. So he was reacting to her attack. And will be humble in my own sight. See, I'm not going to pretend that because I'm king, I have to just always have this, you know, facade. And I can't ever just let my hair down and be enthusiastic. You know, I don't have to always have this kind of air about me where I'm looking down on other people. That's not what he wanted to do. He didn't want to be that way. He wanted to be humble in his own sight. And it's not something that he was putting on. This is how he really felt. He was a humble person. That's why God chose him. "But as for the maidservants of whom you have spoken, by them I will be held in honor." They didn't look down on me for what I did. They didn't feel embarrassed by it. They understood what was going on. They respect me. You didn't, but they did. You know, in other words, a person who is very arrogant, putting on airs and very haughty, you know, he may think he's being respected, but behind the scenes, people are thinking, why that pompous so-and-so, you know, who does he think he is? Sure, he's king, but still, he may be king, but he's still a human. He's still a person. He's still got flaws like everybody else, you know. And if people, you know, act in that haughty, arrogant way, people may respect them superficially, but behind the scenes, they don't. And so this is what he told her. He said, "I am respected by those women that you think, you know, were embarrassed. You may have been embarrassed, but they were not." And unfortunately, because of Michal's attitude, you know, she didn't have children. Verse 23, "Therefore Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death." So you see the difference in attitude, whereas David was one with his people and enthusiastically served his God. Michal had certain pretensions and airs and evidently was very status conscious. And so you have a contrast here. Let's go on now to the seventh chapter. "Now it came to pass when the king was dwelling in his house and the Eternal had given him rest from all his enemies all around, that the king said to Nathan the prophet, 'See now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells inside tent curtains.'" So what was his attitude? His attitude was, why should I have this nice palace, and yet the tabernacle is a fairly modest structure, a kind of portable structure? Shouldn't there be just a beautiful temple to honor God? But it's interesting that God had a very high quality tabernacle. He had materials there that were very high quality. And the Ark of the Covenant, as you know, was a beautiful and very, you know, rich kind of a container. But these were not large items. And the tabernacle was itself not major, and it wasn't permanent, it was portable. In other words, God did not require that the people who lived in very simply in ancient times erect some huge, like cathedral-like structure for him. He was willing to be in a portable structure and a modest structure, high quality, yes, but portable and somewhat modest in a way, a kind of a tent-like structure. And I think there was some symbolism in that, in the sense that it showed that God is in effect everywhere, that he's movable, he's portable, he's all over the place. It also shows that God dwells with the humble. Even though when you walked in there, it was high quality, but it wasn't a building, a major building that would just impress you, you know. And so God was in effect showing them that what's important is the symbolism of the tabernacle, not to be impressed by some huge structure. Now again, I remember, and this is now, I'll go from German class to Spanish class. I remember in my Spanish class, one of my teachers in high school would tell us about how he went to Mexico, and he would see these villages where people lived in hovels. And then you'd come to this huge cathedral, unbelievable. And he was thinking, you know, here are these people living just almost on the animal level, and here the church has this huge structure there, and it didn't seem fair, right to him somehow. It seemed just somehow not right. But I would like to go to the book of Hebrews, in Hebrews the 9th chapter. You know what's interesting about Hebrews? A lot of people don't notice this when they read about it. You know, Hebrews talks about the rituals in the temple, talks about the priesthood, talks about the symbolism there, talks about what it was all about, compares it to the new covenant. But you know what's interesting about Hebrews is that it talks about the tabernacle. It doesn't talk about the temple. It talks about the tabernacle. So it gets down to the very core. It gets down to the material in Exodus about the tabernacle. It doesn't even talk about the beautiful structure that Herod had built or the structure that Solomon had built. It went down to just the core and the symbolism itself and talks about the tabernacle. In Hebrews 9, then indeed even the first covenant had ordinances of divine service and the earthly sanctuary. For a tabernacle was prepared, the first part in which was the lampstand, the table, and the showbread, which is called the sanctuary, and behind the second veil, the part of the tabernacle which is called the holiest of all, which had the golden censer and the ark of the covenant overlaid on all sides with gold, in which were the golden pot and that had the manna, Aaron's rod that budded, and the tablets of the covenant. And above it were the cherubim of glory, overshadowing the mercy seat. Of these we cannot now speak in detail. You know, that wasn't his point right there, but the author here of Hebrews, you know, commented to that extent on it. You know, but you see that the focus is on the tabernacle rather than on the great edifices that were built later on. You know, sometimes people get carried away with big buildings. They have what you might call an edifice complex. Anyway, so we don't, you know, but so here we get into the actual core, the tabernacle itself. So the point I'm trying to make is that it was not God's plan that in those ancient times that there be some huge cathedral-like structure. High quality, yes, but yet modest in a certain way. However, he ultimately did plan to have a temple, but in the millennium, yes, there will be a temple then, and evidently God intended that. And you could understand why in the millennium there would be a temple. At that time, God is going to rule a whole world, and God's way will truly dominate the world. And symbolic of that, there will be this beautiful structure that will be very impressive. When people come to that temple mount in the millennium, they'll see that beautiful temple. I'd like to go to Ezekiel 40. And by the way, Ezekiel 40 is interesting from another point of view. There's a lot of things you can say about Zionism and about the state of Israel, but it does seem to be playing a role in fulfilling prophecy, and it seems to be the first stage of the regathering of Israel and the reestablishment of Israel in the millennium. And here we have a prophecy which was given in the year 573 BC, 2520 years, seven biblical times before 1948, when the state of Israel was declared. We just celebrated, as you know, or we just, you know, I don't mean that everybody celebrated, but historically, on the calendar was the 61st anniversary of that state, and Yom HaAtzmaut, Independence Day in Israel, was last Wednesday, the fifth day of the second month. So we've now had 61 years of the state of Israel. And Israel was declared, of course, on ER the 5th, 1948. And if you look here, in the 25th year of our captivity, in the beginning of the year, on the 10th day of the month, so that's probably the 10th day of Nisan, which is the first month. And so 2,520 years go by, and then 1 month later, roughly, not even a month later, the state of Israel is declared, 2,520 years after this vision. In the 25th year of our captivity, the beginning of the year, on the 10th day, by the way, I'm not saying this to take a political position. You know, we are staying out of the politics of it. I just wanted to note this from a biblical perspective. In the 25th year of our captivity, the beginning of the year, on the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after the city was captured, and you know that it was captured in 587, so this is 573 BC, on the very same day, the hand of the Eternal was upon me, and he took me there. In the visions of God, he took me into the land of Israel. Because he was in captivity. He was in Iraq. All right, he was in Babylon. He was in what is today Iraq. But God took him back to Israel. By the way, if you go back to early in the book of Ezekiel, you'll find that he sees a vision. If you don't mind going back to Ezekiel 1. In Ezekiel 1, I see he's by the river Kebar in the English, C-H-E-B-A-R. But later on, in that, when he talks about that vision, he's in a place called Tel Aviv. And my eye isn't falling on it in the first chapter of Ezekiel, but later on in the book of Ezekiel, maybe it's in the third chapter, he's in a place called Tel Aviv. Is it later on? I think it's...
Verse 15
of
chapter 3.
Okay, good. It's in third chapter. See, my wife is a librarian and is an expert on researching material like this. I don't know how, it's amazing how she does it. Anyway, Ezekiel 3:15, and she didn't have a computer. Ezekiel 3:15. Then I came to the captives at Tel Aviv, or it's in the English it looks like Tel Abib. Tel Abib what? I don't know. Anyway, then I came to the captives at Tel Aviv, who dwelt by the river Chebar, and I sat where they sat, and remained there astonished among them 7 days. So here you have this place of Tel Aviv where Ezekiel was, and that means mound of spring. You know, Aviv, as you know, means spring, and Tel is a mound, means mound of spring. Back a century ago, a little more than a century ago, Theodor Herzl, the father of modern Zionism, from Austria, was writing, of course, in German, because he was an Austrian, was writing in German about the land of Israel, and he called it Alt-Neuland, Old New Land, in German. And when that book was translated into Hebrew, it was called Tel Aviv. Why did they use Alt-Neuland? Why did they use Tel Aviv to translate Alt-Neuland? Because a tel is a mound, and that's what now we call archaeological sites. We call them tells. You probably heard of that term. And then Aviv means spring or renewal. So Tel Aviv is old and new. So Alt-Neuland was translated by the term Tel Aviv. Well, 100 years ago, in the city of Jaffa, and all of us have heard of Jaffa, if we're biblical students, you know, Jaffa was the city of Jonah, the city of Peter. Well, Jaffa, in more modern times, had an Arab majority, and the Jews who were living there finally 100 years ago in 1909 moved out of Jaffa into the an area where there were sand dunes, that was an empty area, and they decided we're going to build a Jewish city here, and a year later they had officially established its name as Tel Aviv, and Tel Aviv eventually became a city today about 400,000 people, and so it's one of the first great modern Jewish cities. And the reason I mention it is because this year it's celebrating its centennial, 1909 to 2009. And they got the term from the book of Ezekiel. But anyway, as important as Tel Aviv may be in modern times, the center of the action spiritually is Jerusalem. And so we're back now in Jerusalem. Now I'm in Ezekiel 40, verse 2. In the visions of God, he took me into the land of Israel and sent me on a very high mountain. On it toward the south was something like the structure of a city. It's also kind of ironic, by the way. One more point about modern times. In 1948, 2,520 years after this vision, when Israel's independence was declared, the leader of Israel was again named David, coincidentally. You know, David Ben-Gurion was the leader of Israel who declared its independence. It's interesting how that worked. Another David. Although I wouldn't, you know, spiritually speaking, compare him to David. Verse 3. He took me there, and behold, there was a man whose appearance was like the appearance of bronze. He had a line of flax and a measuring rod in his hand, and he stood in the gateway. And the man said to me, Son of man, look with your eyes and hear with your ears, and fix your mind on everything I show you, for you are brought here so that I might show them to you. Declare to the house of Israel everything you see. Now there was a wall of all around the outside of the temple, in the house, the bayit, or the temple is also called the house, the bayit, the Beit HaMikdash, you know, the house of the sanctuary. So there was a wall of all around the outside of the house or the temple. In the man's hand was a measuring rod, 6 cubits long, being each a cubit and a handbreadth. And he measured the width of the wall structure, 1 rod, and the height, 1 rod. So on and on it goes, describing this temple. So it shows that God ultimately had in mind a temple, but in the millennium. But in ancient times, he was okay with a tabernacle. But David said, wait a minute, I'm in a palace. I should build something nice for God. I should build a temple for God. So let's go back now to 2 Samuel 7. So God said, I haven't asked you to do this. I appreciate your attitude, though, that you have this kind of an attitude. And a lot of times, that's not the attitude we have. You know, we seem to sometimes give God second importance versus, you know, what importance he should have. Because what's around, the material that's around, you know, tends to take first place because it's physical. We see it, and we smell it, and we touch it, you know. We have to realize God is the reason why we have all these blessings. The reason we're enjoying that nice meal, or the fact that we have a roof over our head, you know, it all goes back to God. Anyway, 2 Samuel 7. Whenever I have moved, well, let's go back. Let's go back to where David says what he says. Now it came to pass when the king was dwelling in his house, and the Eternal had given him. Let's go back to verse 7, to chapter 7. Now it came to pass when the king was dwelling in his house, and the Eternal had given him rest from all his enemies all around, that the king said to Nathan the prophet, "See now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells inside 10 curtains." Then Nathan said to the king, "Go, do all that is in your heart, for the Eternal is with you." He respected David's attitude and he encouraged him. However, God intervened and said, "Wait a minute. David is a military person. I've allowed that, but he's got a lot of blood on his hands. His son will build the temple, Solomon. And Solomon means peace, Shlomo. And Solomon was the one who built it. However, he did allow David to gather materials for it, and that included the help of Gentiles to the north, King Hiram of Tyre. So it included the people of Lebanon. They were included in on it. But Solomon, as you know, built it. However, the fact that David wanted to build it, God allowed him to prepare the services, you know, the musical services, and organize that, and to organize the materials, and then Solomon actually built it. Anyway, in verse 4, "But it happened that night that the word of the Eternal came to Nathan, saying, 'Go and tell my servant David, thus says the Eternal, would you build a house for me to dwell in? For I have not dwelt in a house since the time that I brought the children of Israel up from Egypt, even to this day, but have moved about in a tent and in a tabernacle. Wherever I have moved about with all the children of Israel, have I ever spoken a word to anyone from the tribes of Israel, whom I commanded to shepherd my people of Israel, saying, why have you not built me a house of cedar? I never commanded any leader to do that. Now therefore, thus shall you say to my servant David, thus says the Eternal of hosts, I took you from the sheepfold, from following the sheep, to be ruler over my people, over Israel. And I have been with you wherever you have gone, and have cut off all your enemies from before you, and have made you a great name, like the name of the great men who are on the earth. Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, that they may dwell in a place of their own and move no more." That's, of course, looking to the ultimate future, the millennium, as I've talked about. "Nor shall the sons of wickedness oppress them any more, as previously. Since the time that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and have caused you to rest from all your enemies, also the Eternal tells you that he will make you a house." So we're going to have a time unlike any other time, unique, in that Israel will be free of oppression, will be at peace. He's looking to the far future, But that far future now involves David, because David is going to be the ancestor of the king who will be ruling at that time. David wanted to build God a house. God says, I'm going to build you a house, meaning your dynasty will become the messianic dynasty. He had already promised to give that to Judah, but now he was specifically taking a branch of Judah, the Davidic branch, and saying, David, from you will come that king. In other words, I, God, am going to become human and a descendant of you. And also the Eternal tells you that he will make you a house. When your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. Talking about Solomon. And Solomon ruled, his whole life was not replaced. He shall build a house for my name, the temple of Solomon. And I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. That throne was established forever, and certainly as long as Solomon lived, he was not replaced. However, the ultimate promise goes to David, not to Solomon. Whereas Solomon does not necessarily have a line that lasts forever, David's does, if you put all the scriptures together. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the blows of the sons of men. But my mercy shall not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I removed from before you. So realize your son is going to rule as long as he lives. He will not be removed. However, the family line goes back to you, and from you ultimately will come the ruler, the Messiah. And it comes from David ultimately to Christ. And your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever. This is what God told David. So the Davidic covenant is an eternal covenant. It's irrevocable. According to all these words and according to all this vision, so Nathan spoke to David. Well, obviously, David is overwhelmed at this. I'm going to be the ancestor of the King of Kings. Wow. You know, David was, of course, overwhelmed. Then King David went in and sat before the Eternal. And he said, now, I realize I'm running short on time in one sense, but I'm going to say what I'm going to say. We seem to have this idea of praying that you have to have some special posture when you pray. He was just sitting and talking to God the way I'm sitting and talking to you now. By the way, in case you're wondering, because some of you are listening electronically, I'm seated right now. I could be standing. I could be in any number of postures, but I'm sitting. But anyway, David prayed sitting. And by the way, I don't know of any example in the Bible where anybody ever folded his hands when he prayed. Not that I'm criticizing it, but I don't, at least in my mind, I can't think of any example off the top of my head where anybody ever folded his hands when he prayed. But anyway, here he's sitting and praying. Now that doesn't mean that you know, there isn't a time to be on one's knees. We see examples of that, obviously. You know, praying on one's knees, and you know, we see various examples of how to pray. That's a whole other subject. Anyway, so David's sitting and talking to God here. So where am I? Oh, I'm in verse 18. Then King David went in and sat before the Eternal, and he said, Who am I, O Lord Eternal? And what is my house that you have brought me this far? There's an interesting translation in the NIV. They translate this Sovereign Lord. And yet this was a small thing in your sight, O Lord Eternal. Or the NIV says Sovereign Lord. And you have also, by the way, capital G, capital O, capital D is Yahweh, God's personal name. So I translate it the Eternal, you know. So anyway, if you see capital G-O-D, it's the same as capital L-O-R-D. It's Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, Y-H-W-H. I've said a lot, so I'll go back to verse 18. Then King David went in and sat before the Eternal, and he said, Who am I, O Lord Eternal, and what is my house that you have brought me this far? And yet this was a small thing in your sight, O Lord Eternal, and you have also spoken of your servant's house for a great while to come. Is this the manner of man, O Lord Eternal? Of course not. God can do something so easily that is impossible for human beings. And God here is prophesying what will happen thousands of years into the future. Because he's God, he's unique, he can do that. Now what more can David say to you? For you, Lord Eternal, know your servant. For your word's sake, and according to your own heart, you have done all these great things to make your servant know them. Therefore you are great, O Lord Eternal, for there is none like you, nor is there any God besides you, according to all that we have heard with our ears. Monotheism, right? One God. And also God chose the people of Israel and has a role for them to play in history, and as he has chosen the church in New Testament times. And who is like your people, like Israel, the one nation on the earth whom God went to redeem for himself as a people, to make for himself a name, and to do for yourself great and awesome deeds for your land, before your people whom you redeemed for yourself from Egypt, the nations and their gods? We just celebrated that recently. By the way, it's a month to go to Pentecost. We're going to be thinking about those events again. For you have made your people Israel your very own people forever, and you, eternal, have become their God. And of course, the church is Israel spiritually, as you know from the New Testament. Now, O eternal God, the word which you have spoken concerning your servant and concerning his house, establish it forever and do as you have said. So now he's praying that God would indeed confirm what he said. He's so thrilled about it. So let your name be magnified forever, saying, the Eternal of Hosts is the God over Israel, and let the house of your servant David be established before you. Verse 27. For you, O Eternal of Hosts, God of Israel, have revealed this to your servant, saying, I will build you a house. Therefore your servant has found it in his heart to pray this prayer to you. You notice David's attitude? Oh, sure, I deserved it. No wonder you're doing this for me. You know, of course not. You know, he had tremendous humility. And now, O Lord Eternal, you are God, and your words are true, and you have promised this goodness to your servant. Now, therefore, let it please you to bless the house of your servant, that it may continue before you forever. For you, O Lord Eternal, have spoken it, and with your blessing, let the house of your servant be blessed forever. And indeed, of course, God answered that prayer, and Christ came from that line, and Christ will eventually rule this world, and under him, the resurrected David. I'd like to complete this thought now by going to the book of Revelation. I often end my talks by going to the end of the Bible. So if you go to the book of Revelation, the fifth chapter, here we see how David, who was willing to go above and beyond and who had great faith, was an example for us. David was the ancestor of Christ. We've learned from David a little bit, I hope, today. And I hope it will encourage us to study more material about David as we do our own personal Bible study. And David was the ancestor of Jesus Christ because our Savior was Davidic and divine. So I'd like to go to Revelation 5. And here we find that John has a vision. And in this vision, of course, prophecies are revealed, and only Christ really can reveal prophecy. He inspires the prophecies and he reveals the prophecy. So in Revelation 5 and verse 5, John was weeping because he couldn't understand the prophecy, but now the prophecy is revealed by Christ. Revelation 5, verse 5. But one of the elders said to me, do not weep. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has prevailed to open the scroll and to loose the seven seals. And verse 9, these angelic beings, or these spirit beings in heaven, and they sang a new song, saying, you are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain and have redeemed us to God by your blood out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation, speaking as representatives of the human race, and have made us kings and priests to our God, and we shall reign on the earth. Then I looked, and I heard the voice of many angels around the throne, the living creatures and the elders, and the number of them was 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands of thousands, saying with a loud voice, worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and blessing. And every creature which is in heaven and on the earth and under the earth, and such as are in the sea and all that are in them, I heard saying, blessing and honor and glory and power be to him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb forever and ever. Then the four living creatures said, Amen. And the 24 elders fell down and worshipped him who lives forever and ever. So we are servants of Jesus Christ, the Son of David, the Son of God. Well, I hope this has been of value to those of you who heard it now or who will hear it later. As I said, it's a month to go to Pentecost. We hope that you will stay well and that your Sabbath goes well and the new week ahead goes well. All the best to you and yours.